Hi, my name is Kelly Aldershaw, and along with Elaine Wilkins, we are both the co-founders of the Chrysalis Effect Supported Recovery Program, which is the first ever online holistic recovery program designed to support sufferers of ME, chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia. To find out more, you can visit www.getyourlifebackfromme.com. Elaine suffered for 6 years and I suffered for 7 years with ME, chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia symptoms. They had a devastating effect on both our lives. Having both fully recovered, we went on to live our lives running our own businesses. However, we were never really completely fulfilled in what we were doing. And once we heard about the sad news that somebody actually took their life after suffering for many years with ME, we knew we had to do something. So we decided to put together a basic website and run local workshops in Sussex to help people. However, the response we had from all over the world asking for our help, we realised that maybe this was slightly bigger than we first thought. So we then had to spend the next year working out how we could share our knowledge and experience and connect with some of the best people in the areas of health, nutrition and complementary medicine to enable us to help some of the 17 million people suffering and desperately searching for help with this condition, because we knew that we couldn't find that help when we were suffering. This interview forms part of the inspirational recovery stories and expert interviews that are part of the program. As I mentioned, it's completely holistic and an integral program, looking at nutritional aspects, the endocrine system, the emotional and stress triggers, and more importantly, it looks at the cause of the symptoms instead of just managing them. As once you can access the cause, make the necessary changes, then the symptoms do just start to disappear. Our beliefs are, as many people who have recovered, that these conditions are both physical and emotional, and that it's a combined and integral approach that is needed for recovery. It's not one thing that caused the condition, and it's not one thing that's going to fix it. And it's for that exact reason and the complexity of these conditions is why it is so challenging to know what to do and how to get well. With the lack of understanding from the medical community, and because of this lack of belief that recovery is even possible for so many sufferers, that's one of the reasons it's so hard for people to recover, and why so many people haven't until now. This is why our mission is to shift those beliefs within the community that recovery is absolutely possible, and together with the network of Chrysalis Effect practitioners and our online program, the lives of sufferers and their families are being transformed globally. If you want to find out more, just visit www.getyourlifebackfromme.com, where you can access the free guide on challenging these conditions and beating them. And obviously you can find out more about how the Chrysalis Effect Recovery Program works. But now it's time for your interview. So enjoy and be inspired. Okay, so thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time. Anna is a six-time world champion, 2 times Olympic kayaker. So we're very lucky to be talking to you today, and the reason we are talking to you is because you have suffered and recovered from chronic fatigue syndrome yourself. So I'd love to hear a bit about your story and what your life was like.
Well, so I was an Olympic kayaker. I'd won 3 world championships in marathon kayak racing, competed at the Sydney Olympics in 2000. I was a professional athlete, training 6 days a week, so something between 18 and 22 hours a week. So the immediate assumption for most people was that I was doing too much physical exercise and I was overtraining. Mm-hmm. And that was what I was told initially when I went to the team doctor. Even you're complaining of fatigue and aching muscles and you know, needing lots of sleep, well then they say, well, you've been overdoing it.
Yeah.
But it became, I knew from the very beginning that that wasn't the case. I'd experienced episodes of what I now know to be small mini episodes of CFS, between 2 and 6 weeks, where I had to sort of take a step back from training and go a little bit lighter or even rest for, you know, up to 4 to 6 weeks. And then eventually it sort of hit me full time and that was it. And because of those sort of mini episodes, I was really conscious of the amount of training that I was doing and the volume and the quantity of training. And my coach was really aware of it. So it's, and when it really hit me in April 2003, I hadn't been doing a big volume of training. So I knew that it wasn't anything to do with training, and I knew in my heart that it was something a lot more profound than that.
Yeah. So had you always wanted to be a canoeist or kayaker?
Oh yeah, I've been canoeing since I was 8.
Yeah.
And I was on the British team since I was 14. Did lots of different sports as a kid, all sorts of sports, from running to athletics and judo to hockey to tennis and all sorts.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so I loved sport.
Did you ever do any other jobs, or was
no.
sport the thing you did straight from school?
Yeah, never had another job in my life. And yeah, I went to school, did my A-levels, went to university, all through that, trained hard for canoeing, competed at the Olympics when I was at university, won more championships when I was at university, and then I left uni, became a full-time professional athlete. So yeah, that's been my life. And I think that because I was so passionate about it, because I was so driven, so focused, there's some of my downfalls really. Almost the way I was so determined to succeed, it's almost that the way I was going about that and the approach that I had adopted really wasn't right for me. And I was able to reach the highest level and stay there for a little while, but I couldn't sustain it in the way that I was going about doing it.
And in the way you were going about doing it, what do you mean by that?
So, so for example, leading up to the Sydney Olympics, I changed coach and I started working with a coach who was Canadian and based in Canada for a lot of the time during the summer and based in Florida during the winter, which was great initially, and he was a great coach and I really liked him and I improved a lot under him and he got me to the Olympics in Sydney. But what it meant was that I ended up going abroad to train, which was fine, but when I came home, I ended up training on my own. So my coach was in another country. I didn't have any training partners over here. I didn't want to go and train with the other girls in the UK or the other coaches, so I spent all my time training on my own, which I had the motivation to train on my own, but I didn't realise I needed emotional support. You know, it's pretty tough as a professional athlete, training two or three times a day. I'd get up at, you know, at 6 in the morning, I'd go training, head down to the river, get out, go on my own, no friends to chat to, no coach to talk about the session, no feedback, no emotional support. And then when you're tired, you know, you're getting back, going off to the gym on my own, you know, just, and I'm such a social and gregarious person that it just, you know, wasn't the right environment for me to be in. But I was so focused on, you know, this is what I've got to do. This is a great coach and this is a great training program. And I need to follow this, regardless of the fact that it's probably not ideal because I probably didn't stopped enjoying it a little bit, lost the fun because I had no one to have a laugh with and
so
a bit of banter.
It became more about the destination and not enjoying the journey
exactly.
along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. So that was a big thing for me. And then I started to notice that every time I went on a training camp, if I was with people who I wasn't really close to, then I felt a little bit isolated again. One summer I went to stay in Norway to train with one of the top girls in the sport, and I ended up staying in a house of a friend of mine, but they were away on holiday, so I was in this house on my own, and I'd meet others for training, but I'm in Norway, in Oslo, in a foreign country, living in a house on my own, didn't know anyone. So again, I was isolating myself, and being a real social person, that just wasn't a good environment for me. So those are some of the things that are starting to happen. I also, looking back now, not very good at slowing down and sort of stopping and resting. And as an athlete, you know, you can do amazing amounts of physical training, but if you don't let your body recover in between training properly, then you can't cope with those quantities of training. And although I was good at eating well and getting lots of sleep, during the day in between training I was often rushing about trying to, you know, even if it was just sitting doing emails and going off to meet someone, but just always on the go and never really taking time to just stop and relax and just chill out. You know, in the evening I moved into a flat on my own, and in the evening, just not very good at just sitting out and vegging out on the front of the TV, and I'd be, you know, on the internet doing something and updating my website or my blog, or, you know, just doing stuff all the time and not letting go really. rather than reading like fictional books, I was always reading a, you know, sports psychology book or, you know, just constantly trying to improve, which is what got me to the highest level, but didn't help me stay there. So those are some of the things that were going on. And then when I started to get really ill, I then isolated myself even more by not sharing it with anyone. So by, you know, people knew that I wasn't well, but for example, my mom or my sister say to me, how are you feeling, you know, how's it going and whatever. And I'd say, yeah, it's fine. And because I just didn't want too many questions, and I knew that if I really opened up, I'd just break down into tears, and I couldn't really let on that I wasn't coping. Didn't want to admit that I wasn't coping, that I, you know, I was kind of Anna who doesn't cry, Anna who's tough, Anna who's the Olympic athlete, and she's strong and mentally tough and all of this. And yeah, I was, desperate for, probably now, you know, having done the reverse therapy as I went through it, that was one of the big things that I had to learn to do, was to open up to people, express those emotions. It meant breaking down in tears in front of, you know, close friends who I shouldn't be afraid to do that with, but it was tough for me. So I, you know, so isolating myself was a big part of it. What else? For example, a lot of the sort of conditions that I sort of put on myself, I suppose, which sort of led to that sort of non-stop, got to keep doing, got to keep going, you know, must eat this, must eat that. Too many sort of musts and shoulds and have to's.
And I think that these things do lead to physical symptoms in terms of all the emotional stuff then has an impact on the body in terms of the endocrine system and, you know, the stress. It's like the adrenal glands get put on and they can't switch themselves off.
Absolutely.
And then when that happens, it then affects you, the symptoms, but it also makes you keep going like that. It's like you don't then know how to slow down and how to stop, like you said. So it's like a vicious circle, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you saying that you then started looking at and opening up emotionally, and what realisations did you come to when you started doing that? How did you change some of the things?
Well, I mean, I should sort of take a step back, really, because it wasn't until I did reverse therapy that I was starting to become aware of all these things that I was doing and what all these triggers were. Because prior to that, you know, I did try lots of different treatments and therapies and all sorts of things, and it was a good 15 months of first not knowing, first not understanding, you know, being the usual, you know, it's in your head, get yourself together, all that kind of stuff. Different recovery programs that Team GB doctors put me on and all of that. Anyway, eventually discovered treatment called reverse therapy, and through journaling everything that I was doing every day, the therapist was then able to start to identify some patterns and see what are some of the common triggers. And the process really works by the therapist having identified some of those triggers, then writing a message for you on a card that would say, for me, for example, would say, my symptoms are with me now to remind me to stop isolating myself, or my symptoms are with me now to remind me to remind me to stop putting pressures on myself. I probably had, most people have probably one or two different symptoms and cards, and I probably had about four or five. And my symptoms are with me now to remind me to stop, to open up to people and let them help me. Things like that. And so, just for example, because, you know, people don't have symptoms 24/7 generally, and they switch on and they switch off, and it's amazing how just a conversation can switch them on, or a conversation can switch them off. And for example, the girl who introduced me to reverse therapy is now a great friend of mine. She was I had a sponsor called Pindar, and I went out to Chicago with Pindar for a meeting, and when I was there, this lady called Jacqueline Candle was sort of looking after me, sort of my host. And she knew of someone in the UK who who'd had CFS and used reverse therapy. She told me all about it. Anyway, then she, you know, sort of 6 months later, when I'd started reverse therapy, maybe 3 months later, she came over to the UK and I met her at Heathrow Airport, and we went into Starbucks, had a coffee. And I'd been feeling quite good that morning, and then we sat down after a bit of chit-chat, you know, she then says, so how are you feeling, how's it going, how's the reverse therapy, you know, what are you making progress, all of this. And I did my usual, yeah, everything's good, yeah, reverse therapy's working, and, you know, making good progress and all of that. And I was making progress, but I was still really struggling. Mm. And I was still finding it hard. I wasn't 100% better yet.
Yeah.
And I just sort of brushed it over and pretended that it was fine. And really, someone like Jacqueline, who understood CFS, yep, understood reverse therapy, was a good friend, she was a perfect person to share that with.
Yeah.
And I didn't. And, you know, we had coffee and I left and I felt awful afterwards, so tired and drained and all the symptoms. And that was an example of something that the reverse therapist would pick up on and go, well, it's clear. You know, that was one of those conversations that you could have expressed some emotion and you could have shared it with someone and let someone, she might not have been able to do anything to help you, but just that process of sharing it with someone. So there were a number of things like that. I had to learn to stop counting how many hours sleep I had, clocking what time I go to sleep at night, clocking what time I wake up and counting if that was 8, 9, 10 or 11 hours, because if it was less than about 9 I'd panic. And fear of the symptoms is a massive trigger. So I had to sort of find ways of tricking myself into not fearing the symptoms, and it's almost like by distraction. So for example, when I first started going training again, I would go out, do a really light amount of training, and my body was perfectly capable of doing it, but I was so scared that after I'd done that training I would feel tired again, that I'd worry about it, and obviously I would. So for the first sort of 2 or 3 months of when I first started to get back into training, I would, it was crazy because I would sort of try and plan to have either a friend over for dinner or go and meet friends for dinner or have something to do immediately after training so that I was distracted. Because if I went back to my flat and was on my own, I was single at the time, then I would just have too much time to think. So it was getting quite expensive having to go out for dinner or drinks or, you know, anything just to stop me from getting in my head and thinking too much about it all. But it worked, because then I started to get the confidence that I'd come home and go, actually, for the last 3 hours since I've been training, I've been fine, so I'm okay. And when that started to happen enough times, I didn't need to go out for dinner quite so often and be with people. It was just a confidence thing that actually I've cracked this and I'm okay and I don't need to worry about the symptoms coming back because I'm in control of all these things. I know what certain triggers are.
That's it's so relevant to what we talk about on our program, is that there are a lot of emotional and stress triggers, and when people aren't aware of them, it just becomes a habit and it just becomes part of who they are, and they become an ME sufferer or chronic fatigue sufferer. And the fear of all of that is a massive part of it. But also, like you've been talking about, the emotional stuff. Some people, it's the not being aware that that is what is triggering a lot of their symptoms, you know. And of course there are physical aspects to it. There's the, you know, nutrition. And I guess for you, being an Olympic athlete, nutrition was something that you were already on top of, and you had a good diet and all of those things were in place for you.
Yeah, and that was one of the most frustrating things almost, because I went to one doctor, my sponsor sent me to a big sort of health clinic anyway in the US. And I went to see this one doctor and he did blood tests and asked me what supplements I was taking and what my diet looked like and all of this, and he said, you're taking all the supplements that I recommend, you're taking, eating all the right foods, and, you know, all your blood tests look fine, and so I really don't know how to help you. So that was really frustrating, because perhaps for some people that takes you a little bit step in the right direction, but for me it didn't do anything because I was doing all that already.
And I think, and I know you've said before, that it was about 2 years, wasn't it, from when you came or were diagnosed with fatigue to when you then been able to be back to
start training again.
And I think because that is in the world of ME and chronic fatigue, that's actually a short period of time. for suffering. When you're in it, it feels like a lifetime. But a lot of people, I know for me it was 7 years, for some people it's 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And I think because you had the great solid foundation of your nutrition and everything being in a good place, you didn't have that, all those added issues and all the digestive stuff and all the other stuff that go along with it. So for you, your biggest trigger and the thing you had to change was your all the emotional stuff for you.
Yeah.
And the lifestyle and the pressures you were putting on yourself.
Yeah, I think, you know, a big part of it was emotional, but also the just sort of the rushing around. And that's something that I still have to keep on top of now. Although I'm fine, I know that if I just rush from rushing, I'm often late, and I'm always been late. And that's really bad because I don't like being late. Mm. But I've always got too many things to do that I don't stop in time and give myself enough time, and I sort of arrange things and go, okay, so I've got an appointment to get my hair cut at 2, but then I said I'd meet someone at 3, and then I'd 4 o'clock, and I just sort of schedule in all these things and give myself precisely 20 minutes to get from one place to the next, when really you should allow, you know, 20 or 30 to allow for traffic and things happening and whatever. But I precisely give myself a really tight schedule so that I was rushing from one place to the next to the next to the next. And then because I'm late, I'm going to panic because I'm late, and then I'm hurrying. Mm. And that was a big thing for me. So that was the sort of a physical side of things, that just learning to slow down, learning to sort of say no, and let, you know, upset a few people, let them down a little bit, but realising, you know, one of the big things that my breath therapist was always saying to me is like, what's more important, being late or your health? Letting that person down and saying no and saying I've got to do it next week, or your health. And I just had to keep reminding myself of that, you know, my health has to come first. And it doesn't mean that I can't do things, I just have to be sensible. I was creating some mad schedule that it's just not sustainable, no matter who you are, you know.
And again, you worry about what everyone else will think, don't you?
Yeah.
And it's changing your values and your beliefs around, so actually health is your highest value, and you make your decisions around, you know, what's important for you, and that takes a while to shift to that, doesn't it?
Yeah. So it's not like I was trying to go from to doing nothing and just sort of saying, oh, well, I can only do a couple of things a day, and, you know, I lead a pretty full life, but it's like, let's just keep it in check a little bit.
Yeah.
No one can sustain that kind of level. So
it's creating a bit more balance, isn't it?
Really. So those are some of the things, and just, I think, you know, I was such a driven person, I am such a driven person, that always wanting to do better and succeed, and, you know, just all the small things that, you know, I must eat this and I must eat that, and, you know, as an athlete, and I just sometimes have to just let it go a little bit and create balance.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's almost like, well, as long as I eat well 80% of the time, then it's okay. If I, you know, let myself go 20% of the time, then
that's okay too.
Okay too. And, you know, just little things like that. So some changes of habits and values, and which is some of the hardest parts of it.
Yeah.
Changing habits that, you know, are part of your core, of your being. And
then when you did recover, you went on to do amazing things, didn't you?
Yeah, so I got back, slowly started to do training again, and I think that starting the training again helped me so much, because that's what gave me my confidence again. But again, I had to sort of trick myself in the beginning to sort of do things that, like, I'd be going out training and was mad. I'd like to, this sort of distraction thing, I had a real thing with. I had to try and distract myself from worrying about the symptoms.
Yeah.
And I'd go along and I'd be in my boat paddling along in the canoe, and I had had an MP3 player on, and I'd just like go along singing really loud.
Excellent.
So that I was so focused on singing that I didn't worry about what my body felt like, whether I was tired or not, because I knew I could do it. I was fine. It wasn't going to tire me out to go and do exercise for 30 minutes.
I guess I can imagine people thinking, oh, does that mean that you're not listening to your body if you're pushing it through it? But you'd experienced that you could do that and you didn't relapse before.
Yeah, I mean, the problem was never, ever the amount of training or doing physical exercise.
Mm.
It was all the stuff that was going on outside.
And in your head.
And in my head.
Yeah.
So it was not a dangerous thing for me to be going canoeing and pushing my body hard. And in the first, you know, the first sort of 2 or 3 months, I wasn't going really hard because I needed to go back slowly, not just because of having had the illness, but because I hadn't done exercise for almost 2 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, my body needed to get, you know, I was going to injure myself and all the rest of it if I went too crazy. So, you know, I was going steady, but before, you know, 15 minutes I could have got tired just because of all the stuff. But then I realised that 30 minutes of exercise wasn't going to make me tired. It shouldn't make me tired. This is what I've been doing all my life.
Yeah.
The only thing that's going to make me tired is me worrying about being tired and all the other stuff that goes on off the water.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the singing trick was really crazy because then I'm sure people would like be cycling down the riverbank listening to me and thinking that I'm some mad woman going down the Thames in a canoe singing.
Excellent.
But it helped me, and that was another thing. I'd get off the water, drive back to my flat, and I'd be singing in the car so that I wasn't thinking of, until I got to my friend, who'd then distract me more, so that I just was so focused on something else.
Yeah.
And that was how I kind of got over my fear of the symptoms.
Yeah.
And eventually did more and more training, and got back, and I just went from strength to strength, really, realising that actually, it's not the training. I can do all of that. I've just got to take care of controlling all the other stuff that I do off the water and the emotional side and just slowing down a little bit, having a bit of a better balance, seeing my friends more.
Yeah.
That was a big thing that for me was that every time I went out in the evening with my friends on the weekend, whenever, I didn't have symptoms.
Yeah.
I just, you know, it was a place that I just enjoyed being with my mates, hanging out, having a good time, and then it was as soon as I left that I'd drive home or catch a train home, whatever, and that's when the symptoms started to come back, when I was sort of going back on my own, you know, to my isolated little world.
Yeah.
That's when I'd start, and then I'd be panicking because, oh my God, it's 11:30, and, you know, I should have been in bed 2 hours ago, and, you know, all that nonsense, and that's when the start to feel tired again. But it was really apparent that actually when you're out and having fun and having a good time, then you're okay. And sometimes I had to force myself to go out because I'd be at home thinking, oh, I'm really tired today. And but I had some good friends around me who understood, and I had a couple of people who were really close who had really understood reverse therapy and some of my triggers, and who, when I was wavering, would encourage me and go, no, you've got to go out, get out, you go and see your friends. So that was really interesting for me. And so that sort of balance as well from, you know, as an athlete, you've got to be dedicated and you've got to sleep well and rest and eat well and all of that. And you can't go out on, you know, drinking every weekend because that's not conducive to good performance. But there's balance.
Absolutely.
So that was a big thing for me. So when all of those things were in place, I got back to training, and it wasn't obviously an easy journey back, but it was quite a quick journey back.
Yeah.
Having started reverse therapy September 2004, by Christmas I wrote in my journal symptoms 1 out of 10, 0 being no symptoms whatsoever.
Yeah.
So in beginning of January I did my first 15 minute run with some kids at my class. That was quite exciting. And then by May I was competing at the national championships for selection for the team. Won the nationals. By July I went to the European Championships, and that was the most nerve-wracking race I've ever done, because that was like my big, you know, it was the European Championships all of a sudden, and I went on to win by about a tenth of a second. Over 2 hours race, 2 hours 20 minutes of racing, and I won it by a fraction of a second.
Wow.
So that was a really huge deal for me. After that, it was on to the World Championships for marathon racing. We went off to Australia in Perth, and that was in October of 2005, so 13 months after competing, starting reverse therapy, I was at the World Championships as the European champion. I did an interview with Eurosport before the event, and the guy said to me, so I know that you've had some problems and illnesses and you've overcome them and you got back, and, you know, this is the World Championships, what would it mean for you to win? And I started to give him my answers and I just broke down into tears.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's what it means to win if I win tomorrow. because it was just, you know, it's been such a tough journey to get back and to come all that way.
And I guess doing that and breaking down in two just shows how far you've come, because that's what you used to stop yourself doing.
Yeah.
Actually, you released the emotion.
On TV.
On TV. So that's a massive thing for you.
Yeah, so, and then I went on to win. And then I went back again the following year and won again, and then the following year I won again. I'm on 3 world titles in a row.
Wow.
And then in 2008 I went on to compete at the Olympics in Beijing.
Yeah.
So yeah, but you know, those 3 years, 4 years of coming back, it wasn't all plain sailing, and I had to really keep on top of what I knew were my triggers. And I had a couple of moments when, yeah, it wasn't great, but I never went back to where I was.
Mm. So did you change the way you then trained?
Yeah.
Because you didn't want to be around people?
I absolutely never trained on my own again.
Yeah.
I had a coach. In fact, when I went in 2006, when I went to focus on sprint training for the Olympics, I moved to... So this was the kind of tricky thing. I moved to Nottingham because there was a new national coach there, and there was a big group of girls training there. So I moved to Nottingham to be in a group environment and all of that. But then I moved to a place where I didn't have any friends and didn't have any family, and I stayed and rented a flat on my own. And so it was kind of like almost right, but still not quite right, because I was in a new environment with not the right people around me and not close friends and all of that.
Yeah.
So that I did for about 6 months, and I realised that wasn't going to work for me.
Yeah.
And then luckily the following year I had another coach and new training partners and at home, where everyone was around me and good people, my friends.
And that worked for you.
And that worked for me.
Yeah.
And then I met my husband, and then, I went from strength to strength, really, after that.
So you won 2 gold medals at the Olympics?
No, I competed in 2 Olympic Games.
Oh, okay.
So in Beijing.
Oh, in Beijing.
Having come back from CFS, had won 3 world titles, so 3 gold medals and 1 championship.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
And then an Olympic Games. I didn't win a medal in the Olympics, it was a different discipline, but I got to compete at the Olympics again, which is
that's amazing for anybody, but having been through what you've been through, you know, that's incredible.
Well, for anyone to compete at the Olympics is cool.
Yeah, incredible.
No matter what you've done, just to be a part of an Olympic Games is really special. But so that was it was a great journey, and I ended up retiring from sport Beijing was my last race. I officially retired in April of 2009. And have since gone on to set up a business called Beyond the Barriers. And it's interesting now, because we are focused on performance, health and well-being, and mental resilience, and really dedicated to improving health and performance in individuals and businesses and organisations. But rather than focusing solely on performance, I learned from my own experience that you have to take care of your health. And you have to take care of your sort of mental resilience and that emotional side of things. And for everyone in the working place, if you don't take care of your health, you can't achieve all those targets and goals. And, you know, no matter what sort of leadership training you do and team building and all of that, if you don't have your health, you can't deliver it.
Yeah.
So that's a big part of what we do. Which really ties in well with my story and my own experience, and we're really using the lessons from sport and preventative medicine and bringing them back into the business world.
And you've also got an MBE as well.
I did, I got an MBE to services of sport in the 2010 Years Honours List.
Wow.
So that was really exciting. Yeah, that was really cool. It completely came out of the blue. I didn't know I'd been entered and nominated. Mm. So it was a really nice way to round off my career, and it was, the icing on the cake, really. You know, you win all those medals, and I got various awards, sports personality and things like that, but to be nominated, honoured by the Queen for services to sport is on a different level. So, and alongside so many other amazing sports people, is really, really quite humbling. So.
I think what I've really got the message from you from our conversation is that everybody is so unique, and it's listening to your body and what the message of the symptoms are giving you.
Absolutely.
And making changes around that, because just like you said, you're a really bubbly social person, And, you know, for you, the biggest, sounds like the biggest roadblock was training by yourself, was isolating yourself from the rest of your life, really, because your vision and your passion for what you're doing is, you know, because so many people believe that when you find your passion, you use something you love, then that's it, you know, you're gonna have loads of energy and you're gonna, you know, create a great lifestyle for yourself. But that can also lead to so many challenges, just like it did for you. So it's finding out how you can live your passion and do what you love, but honour yourself in the process.
Yeah, and a big part of it is, you know, getting that balance right, and you know, that's a big part of what we talk about in our business, you know, work-life balance.
Mm.
And it's not just so that you can spend time with your family, which is really important, but to take care of yourself. If you're constantly going, and not taking care of yourself, then it will lead to illness. For some people it's CFS and ME, for others it's, you know, it's depression and anxiety, for it's heart disease, you know, stress manifests itself in different ways, and people have different weaknesses in their body, and it will manifest itself in one illness or another.
And for you, by the sounds of it, and for so many people, the emotional stuff, and I think that is why so many, and the misunderstanding out there in the world about chronic fatigue and ME, is because there is a lot of emotional underlying triggers and causes that create physical symptoms. And I think that's why people say it's all in your head. But actually, a lot of the triggers and the causes are in your head, but then they manifest in physical symptoms.
It's difficult to say it's in your head, isn't it? Because that's sort of...
Yeah, where is your head?
Well, and also that kind of gives the wrong impression of what that means. People say it's in your head, and it kind of makes out that you're... imagining it, or you're making it up, or it's a psychological block or something like that, which it isn't, but in your head, in terms of the thoughts and processes and the emotional centres and the sort of pressures you put yourself under, and, you know, this sort of, for me, that fear of the symptoms, so being in my head, then you're in your head, but in a different way. So that was a big thing that the therapist always said to me, was get out of your head and listen to your body.
Yeah.
Be in your body.
Yeah, it's that mind-body link that you just can't separate. It's massive. And I think when people realise that actually the thoughts that they're thinking are creating their life, and I think people don't realise that, and the power of that, and I think your story is a perfect example of how that is such a massive part of recovery, when you realise and you start listening to what your body is trying to tell you, and you work out what your triggers are. And thankfully there's parts of our programme that help people really tap into that and work out what it is that's triggering and causing a lot of their symptoms, then it really enables people to move through, and you can see what's possible when you come out the other side, because you're living proof of, you know, what you can achieve. And also, I think so many people don't ever go back to the life they had before they were ill, because they learn the lessons and they change the way they live, they change their values, like, you know, health becomes the highest value. And you can see how what you've gone on to do, you would never have probably done in the way you're doing it if you hadn't had the condition you had.
Yeah, I think that I certainly became a better athlete because of what I went through. I wish I hadn't had to go through it, but I learnt a lot of lessons, and I, you know, am able to share those lessons with other people now, and I'm really passionate about that. When I first went to see the reverse therapist, I said, well, he said, I can't promise you that you're going to be able to compete at the highest level again. And I said, well, if I can't do that, then I haven't recovered, because that's my life, that's what I do, and if I should be able to, if I'm better, and I'm healthy, I have to be able to compete at the highest level again and be able to train in the way that I did. So for me, I needed to be able to go back to doing what I was doing, but in a different way.
Yeah.
It was my approach that needed to change. You know, the path that I was taking, the sort of the goals might still have been the same, but the way I went about achieving those goals had to change. And I think that I hope that I can sort of inspire others to realise that it's not a case of having to do less after, you know, in order to not be ill, because I was training, in fact, the coach that I had in the last couple of years of my career, the volume and quantity of training that we did was greater than any of the training I ever did prior to being ill. So we did so much volume of training that it was proof that it's not about physically what you're doing, and you don't have to necessarily, you know, live a sedentary lifestyle in order to not let the symptoms come back. You don't have to, you know, stop yourself going out and doing this and being active and, and leading a full life, because if you're aware of what the triggers are and you're on top of that, you can lead as full a life as possible. If I can go back to winning marathon races which last for two and a quarter hours and doing 24 hours of training a week, then anyone can get back to a full lifestyle.
Absolutely.
As long as you're on top of what you understand, what those symptoms are, what the triggers are. I don't want people to think that you then have to, you know, be careful about how much activity you do and things like
for
that.
For you, it wasn't, absolutely, you learnt the lesson that it wasn't the activity that was was the issue for you, it was actually all the stuff that was going on in your head and all the other, the lifestyle and the lack of balance and not seeing your friends and all of that stuff.
All the pressures I put myself on and the habits and the routines and all of that. And it was absolutely possible to compete as an Olympic athlete and adopt a lifestyle of an athlete, but as long as I've had it in a good perspective and good balance.
And what worked for you.
Yeah, and had the right people around me and let them help me, not being too afraid to let them help me, ask for help, share things, and not isolate myself, all of that stuff.
Because it's so true that everyone is unique and different, because there will be other people in similar situations to you in terms of being an athlete that work really well on their own. And that find that that's how they can train and that's how they can stay focused. Whereas for you, you needed to do it a different way. And I think that's a really good message for people, that there is never going to be one way to get well from a condition like this. You've got to look at all the other areas, and, you know, of course nutrition's important, the endocrine system, and your support network for people around you, and your emotional and your stress triggers and all of that. And for you, that was your key. You know, the other areas were already good for you, because you were already, you know, in place where you had to have good nutrition for you to be an athlete. So I think it's good for people to really see that when you do find out what your triggers are and you start being aware of that and making the changes, then recovery is completely possible and you can go on to do whatever you dream of.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right, everyone is different. But everyone has to listen to their body. That's the biggest message. And that's easy to say, and it sounds really simple, but it's not always easy to do. But when you can start to tune in to what your body's telling you, what are these symptoms or alarm bells, what are they telling you? Listen to the alarm bells. And as long as you keep aware of those and keep listening to your body, then you can do whatever you wish and can fulfill all those ambitions and dreams and get back to your lifestyle.
So many people are always looking outside of themselves, and I did this for a while, and you look outside of yourself for the answers, and you keep thinking trying this will help and trying that will help and this therapy and this treatment and this supplement and these will help, and of course you've got to get a certain amount of that in place, but it's listening to what your body is telling you, because if you keep doing something that is not working for you, it doesn't matter how much, you know, how, just like for you, your nutrition was fantastic, all the other things were in place for you, but you were doing something your body was not allowing you to do and was trying to tell you something, and until you listened to that and made those changes, you know.
Well, it didn't matter how much training I did, I could do all the training in the world that I like, but if I wasn't happy and if my mind and my heart were not healthy, I do all the training that I like, but I was never going to achieve my goals if I didn't listen to my body.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really good message for people. So they listen to what their body is trying to tell them, because those symptoms are there for a reason. And if they, you know, if they listen to that and what they're trying, you know, what it's trying to tell them, then they really can get over this condition and, you know, create a life that they were born to live, really. So thank you so much for your time, and I'm sure people will, you know, can go on the website and find out a bit more about what you're doing. So what's your website address?
So I've got two websites, annahemmings.com, which is where you'll see about my career and some of the other things that I'm doing now, motivational speaking. I share my story with people, both the sporting career but also my journey through CFS. And there's some information on there about my journey through chronic fatigue syndrome. And also I contributed to a book called CFS Recovery Stories, 50 recovery stories. They're all positive stories from people who've recovered in different ways. And I happen to be on the front cover of that book.
Yeah,
you've got the book already.
Yeah.
So that's a great book. That's annahemmings.com, and then my new business, which is about improving health and performance, is called beyondthebarriers.co.uk. Sorry.
Fantastic. Okay, well, if people want to find out a bit more about your inspiring story, then they can go on there. And I just want to say thank you again for your time today. I really appreciate it. You're an inspiration to a lot of people, and I hope people can take from your story the lessons that they really need to hear and make the changes they need to make so they can live the life they deserve, like you have.
Thank you.
So thanks again.